I would like to welcome you to our seventh symposium. We started this program a little more than 2 years ago with a group of citizens in the hopes that we could begin to look at challenging, sometimes tough questions and do so in a very civil environment. And it's been so successful and we're very grateful. We're thrilled that all of you are with us this evening. So the topic tonight is, how are you holding up the pandemic's wide-ranging effects on mental health? This is one thing that we've been talking about nonstop for months. So hopefully it's something that you're thinking about. We have a great panel this evening. And I'm thinking that this will be a really enlightening visit. So I want to introduce our moderator, Chris Coburn. Chris is a Bozeman City Commissioner, and he also is the System Manager for Community Health Improvement at Bozeman Health here in Bozeman. He serves on the Gallatin City County Board of Health, and he was also on the Gallatin COVID-19 Vaccine Task Force. And thank you so much for that, Christopher. Chris is from a family of non-Indigenous Montanans, a family that's been here at least six generations, possibly more. So he has a great love and knowledge for this state and for its people. He's compassionate. He believes in a very inclusive and diverse community. And he thinks long and hard about difficult issues, which makes him a wonderful moderator for us this evening. He is on the board of directors for Pride Foundation and Gender Equity, and sits on the advisory board for the Madison Valley Bank. And according to Christopher, in his spare time, he likes picnics, podcasts, and patio drinks. And I'm going to add library programs at the end. So thank you so much, Christopher, and thank you for being our moderator tonight.
Yes. Thanks, Susan. Thanks for adding my love for public library programs. I'm a huge fan and really excited to be here and really grateful for the Bozeman Public Library for putting on this event tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, great. Well, let's just kick things off. So I have the honor and privilege of getting to introduce our panelists for the evening. So I'm going to start by reading just a quick bio about each of our panelists, and then we'll give them each some time to just kind of say hi and talk about the work that they do. So our first panelist is Jody Murray, and Jody is a licensed clinical professional counselor working in private practice in Bozeman. Jody has over 25 years of experience working with children and their families. Before moving to Bozeman in 2002, she was an elementary school counselor, as well as an outpatient therapist with Peak Wellness Center in Wyoming. She is incredibly passionate about her work with children and their parents. Her extensive training through the Love and Logic Institute has allowed her to travel, presenting parenting workshops in the surrounding states. Thank you so much for being here, Jody. It's great to have you. Our next panelist is Michael Faust, and Michael is an area director for Western Montana Mental Health Center with over 20 years of mental health work experience. Michael is a skilled crisis therapist and is committing to creating a community of one where no family, friend, or neighbor experiences the hurt of suicide. It's great to have you, Michael. Thanks for being here. And our last panelist is Ingrid Ulrey. Ingrid is the policy director at Public Health Seattle and King County, one of the largest metropolitan health departments in the United States. Ingrid has more than 20 years of experience in healthcare policy and advocacy. Previously, she served as the advocacy director for the Washington State Office of AARP. And before that, she was a senior policy analyst for the Service Employees International Union based in Washington, DC. More than 5 years living and working in the Middle East and Southeast Asia gave Ingrid a global perspective on health issues. Ingrid has a master's in public policy from Georgetown University. Ingrid, it's great to have you. Thanks for being here and joining us from Seattle. So my first question for each of you is just, I'm going to create a little bit of space to just share with the group the work that you do, talk about the work that you currently do and how you sort of interact with the behavioral healthcare systems in the places where you live. Let's start with Ingrid. How about you go first?
Sure. Thank you, Christopher. And thanks for that great introduction. I'm the policy director at our health department here in King County, which includes Seattle, but also some very rural areas to the east, up into the Cascade Mountains and down into the south, where we have bigger pockets of poverty and also more diversity in race and ethnicity. So it's a big county. And my role as policy director is to support all different divisions of our department. And as you noted, my background is in aging, healthy aging in particular. So when, and also long-term care. So when the COVID crisis hit, you probably all remember the shock of hearing about Life Care in Kirkland, which is really one of the scariest first outbreaks. The director of our department turned quickly to me and asked me to lead our response to COVID in long-term care facilities. And that has been just a hugely challenging and tragic what has happened in our long-term care facilities. For many months, I was just tracking our response in nursing homes, assisted living, adult family homes. Since December, I've been the co-lead of our vaccine delivery effort here for King County. So just head down, all I've been thinking about is shots in arms.
Thank you, Ingrid. And I just want to say thanks for your work and for, when you were speaking, I was recalling that shock of the first major outbreak we had in your part of the country that really sort of set the tone for what many of us were about to experience. So just want to say thanks for your work there. It means a lot to all of us.
Thank you.
How about we'll move next to Michael Faust. Why don't you talk about the work that you do, Michael, as the area director?
So I work for Western Montana Mental Health Center, and we have 9 centers across largely Western Montana. So I have a region that I serve, which includes Gallatin and Park and Madison and all the way up through Butte. And so my role is to continue to provide effective and efficient, not just crisis response, but outpatient therapy. We have some housing programs that we provide. We have med management as well as our crisis facilities. But currently, I'm also responsible for the crisis system that we provide for Western Montana, which ranges from Libby to Livingston. So that is part of my responsibility as well.
Great. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate that. And last but not least, Jody, how about you tell us about what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. So I've been in private practice here in Bozeman for about 19 years now, and really mainly work with children, families, and also individual adults. I like to spend a lot of time with the families, with the parents, and especially right now because everybody's navigating a really difficult situation. And I feel like kids have kind of been lost in the shuffle a little bit. You know, we've really, as adults, you know, we're trying to keep ourselves above ground and doing well and thriving. And then, you know, our kids are kind of getting lost a little bit. So right now, a lot of my work is supporting these kids in the process that they're experiencing in their grief, in their isolation, and trying to support them and give them some tools to come out of this on the other side with maybe some additional skills.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Jody. And again, thanks for your work. My first real question is something you each kind of touched on, but I bet there's more to it. So, and the way that I hope this goes is I'll have a couple questions that are for specific people, but I'm hoping that each of you can answer any question that you feel like you want to answer or that you feel like you have something to contribute to, which I'm sure will be every single question that I ask. So my first question really is, thinking over, you know, the course of this pandemic over the last 14 months, how has your individual work changed? What things have been added or taken away, or what sort of new skills or new sort of roles have you had to take on throughout this pandemic? And this is a question for anybody who wants to speak to it.
I mean, I'll jump in with the obvious one is we really moved to a lot of virtual work. And that was different. You know, we did a little bit of telehealth prior to the pandemic, but once March hit and things shut down, we were strictly telehealth. So we were trying to serve and connect with our clients in a really different way, which, you know, there's so many benefits to that in that we were able to still continue to provide service. And then there's the difficulty of not being in that space and really connecting on that personal level, you know, with our clients and really being able to read some of the nonverbals and that type of thing that we focus really, you know, heavily on. So pros and cons, I think, with this, it's given us a new way of interacting and providing therapy that we weren't utilizing a lot before. And for many people, it really works. It's effective with their schedule. You know, it takes less time. They're not, they're not worrying about transportation, getting to and from their sessions. So they can just have that hour and still get the service and the support that they need. So definitely, you know, this virtual world is one of the big shifts and changes on that side of things. So,
yeah, thanks for sharing that with us. And I was hoping you'd bring that up because I'm sure as we get through this conversation, we'll talk more about what it's meant to, you know, serve people or to care for people through a computer screen or through a tablet and kind of how that's looked and felt. So, I mean, that does sound like a big shift in all of our lives, but particularly for those who are providing direct care to individuals. How about anybody else? What things have shifted in your work over the past 12 to 14 months as we move through this pandemic?
Well, I feel I already spoke to it a little, Christopher, but I guess everything in my role shifted because at Public Health, we're responsible for addressing a range of public health threats and issues to look out for the overall population health, from bicycle helmets to dementia to community health services at our clinics to maternal and child health and just, you know, a whole host of issues. And when the pandemic hit, we had to focus really had to push everything to the back burner and put all of our weight behind responding to this pandemic, to this emergency response. So my job really did turn into about 90% COVID all the time for the last 14 months. And as anyone in this sector nationwide has experienced, it's been, you know, very, very intense work schedule for all of us and an emergency response. So we stayed in the office for quite some many months and then converted to home. And I think like everybody on the call, just experienced that that whole change of lifestyle and mindset. Instead of getting up and putting on some professional clothing and going to the office, it was working from home and that sense of social isolation that people feel. We were all feeling it, and also watching our kids go into virtual school mode. And my son kind of missing out on a lot of the traditions of senior year in high school. So it's been a hard time for everyone. And I'm just really honored actually to have had the opportunity to be on the front lines of the fight against COVID. It's been a ride.
Yeah. Thanks for speaking to that, Ingrid.
Yeah. It's a good question. Thanks, Chris. You know, I really haven't sat down and thought about what feels like a decade ago, but it's been, what, I guess a year and a half roughly. But the fact that we had to make a decision. We serve people who are in mental health emergencies and crisis, and therefore we're essential workers. And it's difficult to determine whether you're going to ask someone to go and sit and work hard and put themselves in jeopardy at a crisis facility to continue remaining open to serve individuals who are having a mental health emergency, which is life-threatening to them. So we had to have not only business discussions. We had hoped to move virtually. Shoot, I've been here 4 years in Montana. I've been trying to get us to move virtually for 4 years. I thought it would allow us to be more centralized. I thought it would allow us to be able to reach people more quickly. So in some ways, it promoted us moving in a direction that I hoped we could go. I didn't want to go fully virtual, but certainly some form of mixed use of virtual and in person would have been what we preferred. So this sped up some of the ideas we had from even 4 years ago. So that was a positive, but it was a real moral discussion at times. How do you ask people to put themselves at jeopardy when we weren't sure exactly what we were managing ourselves to continue to help others? So in a lot of ways, the isolation for myself didn't occur because I was at the office and I was going to the crisis facility and working there and also with my colleagues. So a little different for me on my end, but regardless, it's had a huge impact on everyone, whether they already had an underlying mental health issue or if they were at home and now working and maybe became unemployed or weren't sure if their job would still be there a year later. So it's had a huge impact.
Yeah.
shifting
things. That's my goal. Yeah. So, I mean, from those descriptions, it's clear that, you know, everybody has had some changes as a result of the pandemic. And even this point that I'm really curious about too, is this like shift in our understanding of what our roles as public health professionals or as counselors or as, you know, directors of a community-based mental health organization, what that role means for a community during a pandemic is, I think, pretty profound. You kind of touched on this a little bit, Michael, but I, you know, we've heard the phrase, the pandemic within the pandemic, sort of more and more frequently. And I'm just wondering if you all can speak to what that means. What are we talking about when we're saying the pandemic within the pandemic? And that's open to anybody who feels like they want to take that one on.
I'd kind of like to hear that from a public health perspective. If Ingrid wouldn't mind, I'll put her on the spot here a little bit, but I'm kind of interested to hear her thoughts on that.
No problem. I'll be sure to do that right back to you. So good point, pandemic within the pandemic. If you think about a whole host of issues from people's personal finances, concern about their job, about their stability of housing, about, you know, if their stability of their own health and the threat, the enhanced threat of COVID to people with underlying health conditions, education and child development, kids being no longer able to go to school. So there are huge health threats that have been exacerbated by COVID, including housing instability and homelessness, unemployment, financial insecurity, as well as a mental health crisis, which, you know, is one of the main topics I know we're going to talk about today, both for children and youth, and also very specifically for older adults, which has been a lot of the focus of my work over the last year, is not only ensuring that people are COVID safe, but also attending to things such as the epidemic of loneliness amongst older adults, especially, but really people of all ages that has been exacerbated by COVID.
Yeah, thanks, Ingrid. Yeah, I'm really fascinated by, you know, that phrase with the pandemic within the pandemic, because it means so many things. I think, you know, what I heard you say and what I really think about that is that we're spending a lot of our time talking about COVID-19 because that's the most pressing emergency that has the most immediate threat to everybody across the entire planet. In our country, in our states, and in our communities, there's also this heightened now understanding of these issues that were challenging at best to start, but are now at the level of crisis because of the changes that have come with the COVID-19 pandemic. So I think that's just an interesting thing. And I wanted to just, you know, name that. I'm sure a lot of people on the call today or in the space with us have heard that pandemic within the pandemic phrase. So my next question is really about hoping each of you can talk a little bit about some of the biggest changes that you've seen in terms of the population level mental health that you're seeing in your work or within your communities or within your day-to-day lives even. And I'm specifically thinking about, the reason I'm asking this question is because I'm just thinking about some of the increase in crisis calls and the sort of things that people are seeking support or help around. So just wanted to sort of open it up to what are some of those changes you're seeing within our populations as it relates to crisis.
And I can speak to that, needless to say, but let me, thank you, Ingrid. I appreciate it. Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. I think it's a fabulous conversation as behavioral health, mental health concerns, depression, anxiety, they are already at pandemic levels across the world. So I think what we were really seeing as much, it is a pandemic within a pandemic, but it was already there. But I think what we see now is our response wasn't with equity and parity to what healthcare has. And even in a pandemic, healthcare was stretched, I mean, without a doubt. But our mental health facilities, very unprepared, very little discussion about our brothers and sisters who are working in inpatient facilities, and did they have the correct PPE? Did they have the protection they needed? Where do mentally ill people in the state hospital go for care, and how are those staff being? So we're talking about first responders. I think there was inequity around just looking at law enforcement and healthcare workers, which was important. But I do think that mental health, what we see now is a system that's really struggling to catch up because of the inequity that was already in place. And so I think it's just a more the heightened sense of awareness around that is something that we definitely are hearing and learning from as we go. So I think that that's something we have to point out, that the pandemic was already here. This is just making it worse because of the inequities. So the acuity is significantly higher. We talked yesterday in preparation for this meeting that the number of suicides in Montana hasn't greatly increased. It's roughly the same in Gallatin County in particular as it was prior to the pandemic. I do think that the longer we move through this, if we cannot get our economy back, the stock market's doing great, but individual workers aren't doing well currently. And therefore, if we can't move towards young people being in school and getting back to some sense of normalcy there, and we're having disillusionment, which we often see during a disaster. So I think the longer that that moves forward, we're going to see more of that pandemic and more of that tsunami of mental health and behavioral health issues coming at us. And we may not, we just may be seeing the tip of that at this time. We're not sure, but the longer this goes, the worse it's going to get on the behavioral health side.
Yeah. And to kind of piggyback on that, you know, part of our conversation that we had yesterday was really talking about some of the statistics in our area specifically. And you know, one of the things that caught my attention was an article that came out last April talking about a 40% reduction in child abuse reports. That was concerning because that meant that they weren't being reported, right? Because these kids were not in school and the teachers, principals, the school staff are mandatory reporters. And so they're the ones reporting the abuse. We know the abuse was still happening. It just wasn't being brought to the attention. So that was a concern. That was a number that was concerning. When we look at, I was visiting with them over at the Help Center. And when we look at some of the increases in regards to their call volume and what's being brought to their attention, they were looking at January 1st to April 1st on average and comparing it to previous years. And substance abuse is one that I think is pretty paramount. It's 147% increase in substance abuse calls to their crisis line, which, you know, that's concerning. We hear about it. We hear about alcohol sales, you know, all of those things. And it's having a huge impact during this pandemic. So, you know, and along with that, the anxiety and the fear is a big one. And that's kind of across the whole spectrum. You know, we have 5-year-olds that are experiencing fear and anxiety, and we have 95-year-olds experiencing fear and anxiety. So a lot of at least what I'm seeing right now is really kind of centered around that, the isolation, the loneliness, and then also the fear. Even now that people are starting to get back out there and people are immunized, there's still a fear of kind of going back out there and living life. So those are some of the big things that we're seeing here locally and individually that I'm seeing as well.
Yeah. And Chris, when you look at the utilization of our crisis facilities, let's just focus at Hope House, our inpatient facility, and we see a 30% increase in utilization rate on our voluntary side. And we're seeing a 50% raise in the number of days on our involuntary side. So 15 days utilized on involuntary inpatient, now up to 25. So we're seeing a significant increase in day usage of our crisis facility. So if we averaged 4 individuals a day, we're up to around 5.5, 6. And we're now, I actually think we have more individuals at 8 beds. We're actually experiencing being full more often than we were before the pandemic. So it's having an impact without a doubt. The acuity, without a doubt, is much more significant in the individuals we see coming in.
Yeah, and I'm interested. I want to just kind of carry this a little bit further in thinking about, you know, you shared, Michael, that at least in Montana or specifically in Carrollton County, we're not really seeing, at least like not currently, an increase in the trend of people who are dying by suicide as we compare it for the same time period year over year. But we are seeing people who are in need of crisis services at much higher levels than we usually do. So why is that concerning? I think a lot of people sometimes look at the main indicator that they're paying attention to as being death by suicide or someone dying by suicide as being something that, you know, is the main thing. But why are some of these other issues, this utilization of crisis services, so concerning from a population health standpoint?
Right. That's a wonderful question, actually. Completed in attempts are two different things, right? So, and I do not have the statistics on attempts, the difference in that. So, and if maybe someone in the audience knows, maybe in law enforcement or someone could help us with that. I apologize for not having that statistic. I will look it up though. So if it's something we can track, generally going to track that through law enforcement or maybe the ER, it would be, and sometimes we don't know if it's an attempt. We're not sure. You can't tell. So look, the importance is that we were not, like I said earlier, we weren't prepared. We have an inequity of reimbursement rates. We have an inequity of cost sharing, human resource sharing, financial sharing. And we're not prepared to handle the level of acuity we're seeing. So as a result, we're having to catch up and rethink ourselves quite a bit. It's a wonderful time of growth and learning. It's unfortunate that people have to be in the position they're in to feel as though they can't get the response they need when they need it and how they need it, which is what we want to provide currently. So I think that's one thing that when we think about as a crisis system is that we weren't prepared for this level of acuity because we've never seen it before. But we knew we were headed that way. This just put us kind of over the tipping point, so to speak.
Great, thank you. Does anyone else have any thoughts about that? Why sort of this rise in crisis services is alarming to folks?
I would just validate that the same trends that you're describing for Montana, our data holds in Seattle, King County, and across Washington State. Huge uptick in overdose deaths, as well as suicide ideation, is like the really big threatening trend lines that are of concern. And then also some bumps in just other indicators of mental health, like people reporting feeling anxious, depressed, or worried, or losing interest. So it's across the board, definitely all these things becoming more concerning, trend lines going up. For older people, some of this data is mixed, and we have some theories about that, which I can talk about later. But I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that does. Thank you. And it's a great, I wanted to kind of talk more specifically about the impact of the pandemic on older adults. So you kind of, I think it's a good time to talk about that now. For many people, the health impacts of COVID-19 on older adults is really well understood. It's really well documented. It's something we hear a lot about. I'm wondering if you can speak to a little bit about the behavioral health impacts this pandemic has had and continues to have on older adults. And also, we have a question in the chat box too about what specifically King County has done to address some of those things as well.
Sure. I have to just start with the physical, the threat to people's physical health has just been unbelievable. We had, of the people who've died in King County, over 56% were people associated with long-term care facilities. So it's just been brutal in terms of a very, very high risk of serious illness, hospitalization, and death for older people is exponentially higher than younger people, which is why it made total sense that older people were first at the gate for the vaccine. But there's also been collateral damage from the protective measures put in place to stop the spread of COVID-19. So a really vivid example of that are if you think about the nursing homes and the visitor restrictions and the restrictions on their activity, even to go to the dining hall and see and talk to others. I saw that a lot firsthand and talked to families. And it was brutal. People were expressing that their loved ones were, you know, rapidly declining because their link to their visitors, their spouse or their children who kept them, you know, feeling loved and feeling part of the broader world were severed. And the window visits, you know, everyone was creative and tried to do what we can to still make people living inside facilities know that they were continued to be loved and cared about. But it was really brutal because they were literally locked in their rooms. And it was just the mental health impacts of that were severe. And we were also seeing physical decline, which there's a connection between the mind and body and people physically declining because of that lack of visitation. And in parallel, you know, people, the stay-at-home orders also had the same effect of exacerbating pre-existing challenges with social isolation in older adults. So in terms of what is public health doing about that, there was a push to find that right balance, like to start to roll back. We had quite a lot of debate and discussion in our state, because it was really state regulation around when we could remove some of those restrictions and allow more visitation. That was a big issue in taking the full picture into account, not only the physical threat of COVID, but the emotional and mental health threat of social isolation and the trade-off between the two. And then working in community with a huge range of social service providers, senior centers, which, you know, they were closed during COVID, but got super creative about using virtual formats like this to continue to keep people connected, Meals on Wheels still delivering. So all the host of social services for older adults amped up and got creative about how to serve people in a way that didn't create more COVID risk.
Yeah, thank you, Ingrid. I was really glad to hear you respond to that. And I think, you know, for myself also working in the public health space, it is oftentimes the whole, everything about public health practice is really trying to find a good, appropriate balance between things that will keep the community safe as a whole. And so really thinking about, okay, how do we fine tune some of these protective measures that are critically important to keep the entire population healthy, but also being able to understand like that the things that we're doing to protect the whole will have disproportionate and unintended in many cases consequences for certain people in population, and being responsive to that and understanding how that, how those things work together. So thank you for, speaking to that a little bit. There's a question from the chat box that I want to get to that I was trying to find a really awesome way to fit in, but I think I'm just going to ask it because I think it's important. So the question from a person in the audience is, during the pandemic time, so during this current pandemic, have you found that there are types of services you have been unable to provide, especially for those who already have a diagnosis of some type of mental illness? So the question really is, are there things that you haven't been able to do during the pandemic that are important? And has that, you know, impacted people, maybe disproportionately, specifically people who are already diagnosed with some type of mental illness? And I think, you know, any one of you could answer that, but looking to potentially Michael or Jody to answer that from the clinical practice side of things.
So one of the things that I'm thinking of when you ask that question is some of the older population not being as hooked in or as comfortable with technology, right? So being able to continue to work with them through a platform such as Zoom is really difficult, right? Because maybe they don't have the technology in the first place, or they don't know how to use it. It's hard for them to navigate. And so that's one of the populations that I feel like, again, like Ingrid is saying, I mean, it's hit pretty hard because continuing to work with them, like maybe we were working with them before, it just wasn't as easy with that age group. Now with the younger population in our youth, they're very technologically savvy, right? They're teaching us how to do this. So for them, getting on and doing this type of doing a clinical session via, you know, the computer, that was easy. That was simple. That was natural for them. But some of our older individuals, that was a real barrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for speaking that. And I'm curious to hear what you have to say, Michael, but I think that piece that I really heard from that really made me think about the way we've been talking about so far is that there's a really critical equity piece within the response to the pandemic and the ways that we're able to interact and the sort of reliance on this underlying assumption that okay, we'll just switch to online, but not everybody has access to the internet. Not everybody is able to use a computer or use a smartphone, either because they don't know how to, or they don't have access to one. And so really, like, that as being a piece of, you know, contributing to why we were not able to meet the needs of some people, and, you know, you know, potentially huge populations of people like you named, Jody.
Right. Thank you. We didn't have reimbursement rates for virtual. We didn't, or tele. So you speak of inequity. It was, there was some virtual reimbursement, but it was at a lesser rate. It wasn't being utilized as much, and it wasn't being promoted as a really solid form, even though the research says that is a solid form of treatment. And the medical world has been using it for years. And I'm sure in the medical world, they weren't just treating individuals because they had a heart attack. They were having to measure whether or not the person was depressed because of maybe loss of functioning or family loss or what it might be. So they've been using this for a long time with proven effectiveness. So that was a real challenge. So your point about inequity, definitely, and not having the equipment. But, you know, Jody brought up something is that we kind of focus on. So the answer is yes to the question. And we often focus on the individual at home, the user, the end user, but the front end user, we have to learn how to repurpose ourselves too. And a lot of folks didn't believe it in our field, which makes sense. I get it. Didn't really believe it was going to be that personal touch, that caring touch that is so usual about our work. So the stress that it places on the individual worker as well to believe they're doing an adequate job that they could tell previously by being in the same room. That's a big impact. So when you're looking at, do we have to close or not provide services directly for those who have already been diagnosed? That's an interesting question. I want to think on that for a minute. But what I do think that as a whole, we weren't able to respond rapidly. So then when people are scared of working in congregate care during a pandemic, you put stress of moving into the home, not having the right equipment, you have a worker shortage coming your way is what you have. And we have that. Matter of fact, Montana is a decade long shortage of workers. We won't probably until 2025 have enough new workers in our workforce to recover from this. So it's still going to, but the pandemic really hurt the ability to provide those services that the person was asking about. So yes, yeah. we shut our crisis facility in Gallatin was closed for nearly 6 months because I couldn't staff it. I had to make a choice. Do I have 8 voluntary beds open or 2 involuntary beds? I couldn't do all 10 because I didn't have I had a shortage of staff that didn't allow us to operate safely. And so we couldn't serve both purposes, unfortunately. We still found placement for those individuals. It just wasn't in the county.
Yeah.
So that was one piece. But we saw workers leave our providership. So we've not been able to serve as many people as we'd like because of that.
Yeah. That's great, Michael. Yeah. Sorry, Jody. Go ahead.
Another thought, you know, as I'm listening to Michael, one of the other barriers that we've had is sometimes it's not a safe space to work with these individuals. Sometimes these individuals have experienced an extreme amount of trauma. Maybe they're in a domestic abusive situation, you know, so for them to be in the space, in their home, in therapy was not safe. And so those people, you know, they have a diagnosis, they've been working with somebody, and did it wasn't an appropriate setup for them, right? Due to their safety. So that one was tough as well.
And you mean in those situations, you could be causing more harm to somebody by trying to be therapeutic, because that could be a really unsafe environment for them to be, you know, sharing their concerns or their anxieties or their truths with someone. Thank you for bringing that into the conversation. I also just wanted to, there was a question in the chat box that I think you spoke to a little bit, Michael, just now, but the question is really about, with all of these COVID, with like all the COVID money, quote unquote, the COVID relief money, why is it hard to fund positions or get to find ways to pay for services or pay for supplies? How is that still an issue when we're, you know, confronted with the fact that we're seeing, you know, huge allocations of money to states and, you know, local governments?
Right. Well, the first round of those dollars just kept us stood up while we tried to transition, because we were losing productivity. So the number one problem we had was that you had people walking into the office and now you've gone home and you don't have a computer to perform this work. They don't either. So you have a school-based program. Well, you're not in class anymore. How do you get to your young people? And you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a month standing up those programs, but you don't have clients that you can see. And there's no telephone codes, poorly reimbursed virtual codes. So all of a sudden you're not making money, you're spending money. So those dollars really were just able to keep us moving and afloat is really what they were designed for. So they did that to some degree. The current dollars we're seeing, $130,000 came in, but it's not appropriate for what we're trying to do. The dollars can't be spent appropriately. There was this understanding that, or belief that a lot of the individuals would become uninsured because of unemployment, potentially. Well, we've not seen that to hold true, but that money is tied to individuals who are uninsured. Most individuals we see in community mental health are Medicaid, Medicare recipients. So, and then with the Medicaid expansion, it allows people to, where they used to maybe become uninsured with the expansion piece, they now can receive Medicaid benefits at a higher rate. So most of the people who come to community mental health have Medicaid or Medicare. So, and a lot of the dollars that are coming in from the federal government are tied to individuals who are uninsured. And they also are tied to individuals who are uninsured and have a severe disabling mental health issue. So now you have a very small group of individuals, and those individuals who are often what's called SDMI often are insured by Medicaid, and or you can move them towards Medicaid rapidly. So the funding isn't fitting the need, is essentially what's occurring. But those first millions of dollars that came in, didn't come to us, but that came in through flow through the federal, those just kept us going because we couldn't keep up. There was no productivity happening.
Yeah, thanks for speaking that a little bit, Michael. I know I do really recognize that not everyone who is attending tonight is like us, like either healthcare, health policy, or public policy nerds. So it's like can be really complicated to understand how, like, why those pieces are so challenging. But you kind of spoke to that in a really nice way. So thanks for doing that. I want to switch gears just a little bit to talk about kids and young people, adolescents. And I'm wondering, specifically you, Jody, if you can talk about, you know, as in your work, as you work with, you know, younger people, kids, adolescents and their parents potentially too, how has this pandemic uniquely impacted kids and their behavioral health just in general?
Yeah. And that's a great topic, and I could probably talk for hours on this, so I'm going to try and condense it a little bit to a couple main things that we're seeing. One is screen use and social media. So that has increased drastically, and along with that, we see an increase in depression and anxiety. So like Michael was saying, some of these things were already present, but the pandemic really exacerbated them. It really magnified some of these things, and so with the increase in screen time, you know, devices, social media, that type of thing, we do see an increase also in anxiety and depression in our youth. Along with that, we also see a decrease in this opportunity developmentally for these kids to have been out interacting in person, reading social cues, just having this social development that they would have typically been experiencing. And so there's a little bit of a disconnect, I guess, there. The other thing that I'm really seeing with these kids is that they're experiencing the ripple effect from the discord in adults' lives, right? In the grownups around them. And so whether it's, you know, our own anxiety about the pandemic or, you know, the physical health, the jobs, whatever that might be, or we have to remember what the political climate was like when COVID hit. And so that was already bringing about a tremendous amount of stress and discord among individuals that these kids were feeling. And I think it just really intensified with COVID and being in the home together without those outlets that they would typically have. it's interesting what some of the school counselors are finding is that there's a flip-flop. So kids who were doing pretty well and pretty stabilized before the pandemic are struggling now. Kids that they wouldn't have expected to struggle are those kids that are struggling, and vice versa. Kids who were struggling before the pandemic are actually doing better at this point. And I don't know what that's about. I think that's going to be a really interesting one to follow. I do think, you know, these kids are impacted more than we know right now. And I think they're experiencing a tremendous amount of isolation and grief and loss. You know, Ingrid mentioned the high school thing. I had a daughter also last year of high school. So there's no prom, there's no graduation. You know, there's all of these life events, and even our younger kids, you know, summer camp that they count on every year, going to grandma's for a week in the summer. A lot of those pieces, they're really experiencing the loss and grief associated with some of that. My hope is that we're building some resiliency. I'm always like, what's the positive that could come out for these kids? And I'm hoping that they're building some resiliency and some skills, and know that, you know, looking back, like, hey, I made it through that, and that was hard. I can do this, you know? So that is my hope, but they are profoundly impacted. And I think we're going to see more of that as we're coming out.
Yeah. In that, there was a question in the chat, I think, that probably a few people have, that, you know, if you're someone who's a parent or someone who cares for a child, and you are aware that young people are experiencing this in a really profound way, ways that we maybe don't know yet, but could be catastrophic, what are some signs and what are some things that people should be paying attention to as they kind of check in with the behavioral health and the sort of mental wellness of their kids in their lives?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is pretty consistent, you know, with what we look at outside of a pandemic. Parents, though, right now are seeing it in kids that they had never seen it before, right? And so I think it's always, you know, an indication if we see kind of a drastic switch in personality, behavior, disinterest in things that they are typically interested in, pulling away from, you know, maybe activities that they were highly involved in. Kind of this not seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, right? That helplessness, like this is never going to get better. Everything's changed. Kind of some of that despair and gloom, you know, a lack of forward thinking. You know, are they talking about the future? Are they talking about goals? Are they still excited about, you know, going to college? Are they still excited about playing football next year at the high school? So I think we really want to try and have those conversations, but it's such a fine line as parents. You know, we want to have the conversations, and sometimes it feels like we're pushing, right? And so those of you that are parents probably know, sometimes the most powerful conversations we have with our kids are in the car. And I always recommend to parents, you know, if you're concerned about your kids, get in the car and go for a ride. I don't care what you're doing. You know, you make something up and you go drive up to Highlight to see the water level. Maybe you go, you know, you take them to Dairy Queen to get an ice cream cone and you take the long way home. But sometimes in the car, you have that lack of intimacy. You don't have eye contact. And so it's not quite as scary. And so sometimes they'll open up a little bit more in those situations. But absolutely, if you're concerned, reach out to somebody, reach out to a professional that can, you know, sometimes we're able to have a conversation with the parents and we never need to bring the kids in. We can do that work through the parents and help guide them in how to react and respond, especially if the child is resistant to counseling, right? But I would definitely say reach out if it just seems off, you know. Are they eating? Are they sleeping? Sleep's a big one. It's a big indicator. Anger, aggression, those are symptoms of depression. So I think we want to just, you know, we have our eyes open a little bit wider probably right now, and not in a paranoid way, right? That's the other piece that's hard as parents, you know, not to see things that maybe aren't there.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Jody. When you were speaking, it brought me back to my childhood and like, yeah, the car rides with my mom were definitely those times of connection. So that's just, that hit home for me. What else do people think about that? What are some other signs? And I think, you know, there's a question in the chat that I think could be answered in the same way, which is just, you know, on that last point about just being more aware and, you know, kind of keeping a closer eye on people. There's this role of screenings that we do in the healthcare setting. We do them in the public health setting, we do them in the school setting. So maybe speaking to this through the lens of how can those screening tools be used in an effective way, in an impactful way, particularly for people who are experiencing high levels of stress, which is basically everybody.
Right. Ingrid, do you mind if I jump in here?
Oh, please.
So if I could, I had a little experience working with young people myself, so I'll try to follow up with Jody as best I can. She's in the mix every day with young people. So, you know, one thing I think that we don't want to become like parent psychologists. I think that's hard. I think Jody was touching on that. Like, it's too intimate sometimes for our young people. But here's the thing is that there are some indicators, I think, that a pandemic can make us rethink and reshape about ourselves, because 75% of teenagers in particular, but mostly all young people, and this is kind of Peter Benson's Search Institute stuff, is that, and if you're a parent, please, Search Institute, go look at 40 developmental assets, internal external assets, so important to understanding how we thrive as young people, not just become resilient. So important underlying developmental work that you can reach by some simple questions. Number one is, ask your young person, what sparks them? What is their spark? And that doesn't mean I'm good at math. Math just might be something I'm good at, but I really am an artist. But you know what? I don't really draw that great, but I really love drawing. That's my thing. It sparks me, although I may never make a living at it. I might like just playing volleyball and sitting on the bench because I love volleyball, but I'm never going to become a scholar of volleyball. So what, you know me for who I am, not what I do. And so if we're a parent and we say, what sparks you? And we know that, and they can identify it. Now, a year into a pandemic, if you see that spark changing, you don't have to have a diagnosis. You already know their spark is this. So if they're losing connection to that spark because of the pandemic, you know internally that's going to cause some asset challenges. So then how do you begin making sure that spark is fed? So now it's not about depression. It's about getting them to a place of strength of their art gift, that type thing. So I think that's important to keep in mind. So ask your young people, what is your spark? What makes you your most beautiful self? When you're doing something, what is it that makes you your most beautiful self? And if they can still attach to that thing and feel grounded in it, boom, you're good. You're solid, because they feel really strong about that. And then what you'll find is that the assets of identity, the assets of community connectedness, the asset of being connected to school are really good measure of how well a young person is thriving. And so then you could say, my spark's here, it's really strong, I still am connected to it, and maybe I'm not getting it like I used to, but then let's talk about those three areas of identity, school connectedness, and community connectedness. How can we still get those things to improve that? I think that's an important way we can go about talking to young people without having to be the psychologist in the family.
That's great. Thank you, Michael. I think that's really powerful to think about. What are the things that make us excited and happy and bring us joy, and checking in to make sure that, you know, we still have access to those things and we're still experiencing that same level. I did ask that question about screening. So I'm just curious if anybody has any thoughts about the importance of sort of screenings in healthcare settings or school settings that are related to behavioral health. And I think maybe even from like the public health perspective, how we use the information that we gain from those to make informed public health decisions, or what they can tell us about the kind of care that our community might need.
Yeah, just very briefly, the behavioral health screening tools, there are many different types available, are just a really powerful tool. And we use them consistently across King County. And they can reveal key indicators that are not only for an individual student or child, but are prevalent trends. So issues around screen time, We have in King County have a survey of fifth graders and eighth graders and 10th graders routinely year after year after year, and asking them the same questions about marijuana use or other types of drug use or sexual behaviors. And it's very informative to see how those change over time, to know what's needed in terms of, education, resources, as well as just core behavioral health supports.
Yeah, that's great. And I think this is my last question about screening, just because, working in, I've worked pretty much my entire career in a healthcare setting through the public health lens. And, I'm always a super big advocate for screenings of all kinds. So it kind of helps get a pulse on what's going on. We hear a lot from providers, individuals, that I don't really want to screen for something if I don't have a way to help that person, or if I don't have a way. So how do you speak to providers about that sort of, as it relates to particularly screenings for behavioral health concerns, the importance of doing those, even if there's not a robust network of providers that you can refer them to? What is that like, and why is that important?
I just mentioned one thing. It's just, you don't ask, you won't know. So one example is the opioid crisis. There's a cultural assumption that that's not an issue for older adults. And we had a cross-sector convening where we had aging network, healthcare providers, behavioral health folks, and really dug down, and because we were finding that actually the national data was saying that overdose deaths related to opioid use were actually rising the fastest amongst people 65 plus. So really going into a conversation, typically in a provider visit, an older adult is not asked about taboo topics such as, you're using opioids for pain, and then having a deeper conversation about that and how it's impacting their life, or about sexual behaviors. And actually also sexually transmitted diseases are also very much on the rise more quickly amongst any other age group among older adults. And many of the providers don't think to ask older adults about sexual behaviors because of stereotypes.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's pretty powerful to think about, is that there's one of the reasons that a provider might consider using screening tools across the board is, one, it helps us not to overcome maybe any unknown or unseen bias that we don't know we have. So that's why we're not asking questions. It also might be open the door to have conversations that really need to be had, but there's no other way for us to know about it unless we just ask that question. Maybe a screening tool can be a comfortable way to do that. So that's great. Thank you for sharing that. I have just a couple.
Chris, go ahead, Michael. Can I jump in?
So yeah, please.
That this is fundamental to a large part of how we're going to manage the pandemic within the pandemic, right? This is just a really important conversation, and I didn't want to miss an opportunity to plug what we've already stood up in Gallatin, because they've done a good job, and we're not there yet. We've not arrived fully at an example that I think is the best opportunity that we can put out. But I do think we have grassroots movement in urgent care. If you cannot screen someone and then urgently move them to a place where they can get the right mix of or matrix of services they need, you're right, people aren't going to ask. I agree with Ingrid. Please ask. We want you to ask. But if I can't move you to somewhere to get the mental health or behavioral health care you need, then I'm going to be now in a place where I've asked and may have stirred something that could be harmful to you. So the urgent care need that we've stood up, and I have two wonderful care coordinators that work there, Grace and Jesse. And they're there. They will, anyone who walks in the door urgently, we will begin working towards a mental health resolution and or putting them into seeing the right individual provider or therapist. And we want to do that urgently. This is what we need. We want the individual primary practitioner to ask a question, complete a screening, and then give us a call and say, hey, this individual really needs to be seen. Can you get them a therapist right now? And we should be able to say, yes, absolutely. The biggest barrier would be, how do we get them here? Or do we just need to get them in front of a computer? Then therefore there is no more barrier. So those are the type of things I do agree with you. We're going to have to reshape. Those are the inequities I was talking about earlier. We have to reshape our thinking about that a mental health not just a crisis, but someone who's just not feeling well that day needs to be able to walk in the door and not be handed a card that says come back in 2 weeks. That's just not an acceptable response.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Michael. I think there was a question in the chat that you just spoke to, but I want to make sure it's clear that said that urgent care that you spoke about, that was a partnership effort. That was a collaborative effort. Can you just name some of those partners that made that happen in our
community? Yeah, absolutely. And I meant to just a second ago, but my mind, I'm getting old, can't remember everything. Okay. So our partnerships with Bozeman Health and the Help Center, 2-in-1 Help Center in Gallatin, just wonderful partners in standing this up and recognizing at the very beginning that we needed to be able to respond urgently to what we knew was going to become the pandemic within the pandemic. And we're learning and growing from it. It's been successful. We want it to be more successful. But if we can rethink our whole system in that way, so I can't say enough about those two groups of individuals I've been working with, Maureen and Christina, just been wonderful getting this done and being really innovative and thoughtful from day one around what the pandemic was really going to be like.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I have a couple more questions, a couple in the chat. So I'm just going to try and get through them. And if anybody has any questions for the group, please put them in the Q&A, and I'll start to run through them as we move towards the last half hour of our time together. So the question I have that we talked about a little bit yesterday and when we met to sort of talk about this panel and what we wanted to discuss was, and it came up in the chat as well, you know, each of you in your own ways and in your own professional practices are really well-versed in trauma and the impact of trauma. And I'm wondering, the thing I'm kind of curious about is how might the experience of grief and loss during a pandemic be a little bit different than during other times of stress? Like, let's say someone who's experiencing a hurricane or living through some sort of other natural disaster. How might the experience of grief and loss be a little bit different during a pandemic? And maybe the next follow-up question is, what can people do with that as they move through this next phase of the pandemic? And that's open to anybody who wants to speak about it.
I'm going to defer to the mental health professionals here.
Can't wait to hear what Jody has to say.
Pressure's on you, Jody.
Oh, good, good. So I'm gonna answer the second part first, Chris, and kind of go off what Michael was saying. I think, you know, that normalcy and returning to that feeling is about getting our spark, right? Like, what's our spark as adults as well? And are we tapping into that? Are we giving that the time and attention that it deserves in our life? And I know many of us are not, right? We've become very consumed by these pieces of the pandemic that are really draining us. So what are we doing that's feeding us? How are we getting energized again? How are we finding that spark for ourselves? I think that's a big one. You know, what are our hobbies? What were our hobbies before the pandemic? And really kind of getting back into some of those pieces that felt normal pre-pandemic, I think is really important. And then also that support system, however you can reach out and connect, because I promise you, you're not alone in whatever it is that you're experiencing. And so connecting with others, I think, to feel that support, have some grace with yourself. I think the patience with ourselves and one another, I think are big, but I really think we became so disconnected from many things that were normal. And so now it's just trying to get some of those back, right? Piece by piece, just baby steps. And so maybe, you know, having that conversation with yourself on what is my spark, and am I nurturing that? Am I giving it the attention that it deserves to be able to get back to that sense of normalcy? So I wanted to hit on that part of your question first, because I like the forward thinking. I like, okay, we're coming out of this. How are we going to do that?
And I think going back to the question, like, how does this compare to other mental health responses to other tragic events? And one thing about COVID that's different than if you look at a community trying to recover from a fire or an earthquake or a plane crash or 9/11, you know, we all, you know, well, some of us of the right age remember that. that there's a stark point in time. And then after that, there's the move to recovery. With COVID, I think one of the hardest things for everyone is we've been in it for the long haul, and no one's totally clear when it's going to end. I mean, clearly we're getting out of the woods, but there's the ongoing threat of variants and ongoing challenges. And will the vaccine, or is there breakthrough cases of COVID? And are we ever going to live a normal life again without communicable disease being such a predominant threat to society? So that's pretty daunting. But I think the flip is really kind of going back to where Jody was talking about, is this resilience. That people, we have to just focus on the silver linings. I mean, you mentioned the digital divide of people not having access to technology, especially working with older adults. One silver lining I've seen with older adults is like, oh my gosh, you know, I figured out how to work the iPad, and it's just opened up all these new windows. Or I started doing yoga on a television program, or the new things that we've discovered. Or even people saying, I went to a virtual celebration, whether it was a graduation party or a funeral, and I was actually amazed at how well people could connect in that forum, and how I would never have had my cousins from, you know, across the country. We wouldn't have all been together if we hadn't learned through COVID how to do this in a digital way. So remembering the silver linings is really key. Yeah. Of the new normal. What are the silver linings of the new normal? Working from home's not that bad. Not having so much traffic's not that bad. So learning how we've learned in some ways how to live better, and we need to grab those things and carry them forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the piece for the trauma piece is a couple things, and building off that idea of what how we normally move through a disaster. And this is a pandemic. It's not necessarily, it's a disaster, but it the reconstruction of a pandemic doesn't look like post Katrina, where maybe you have better facilities to manage water, and then you reconstruct homes, you know. But this is a real unsettling of a whole system of how we interact with one another as human beings. And will we ever get back to that place? And everyone's going to experience that differently. I think that's the piece we have to make room for. So when I think of what the trauma might be, and I can't specifically say, I mean, I could talk about the stress that this could cause within young people and things like that. And we could, and Jody could do a day's talks on that, I'm sure. But I think for tonight, for me, I think it's important to say we need to make space to know that everyone has engaged and participated in this pandemic in a different way. So we can't spin out of this saying, oh, well, this is the way you deal with a pandemic. No, I think if we're going to look at trauma work, we have to give every individual the opportunity to have the space to experience in their own way and be able to tell their story in their own way. And I think that, as we move through the trauma work, would be an important piece to keep in mind.
Yeah.
And that's where, going back to the whole grief and loss, right? I think there's differences, but there's also consistencies. And that big one is, everybody grieves differently. Everybody experiences loss differently. And that path of healing is so individual and unique. And none of us have lived through a pandemic. So, you know, we don't know. But I think, you know, there are going to be those consistencies. And so, again, just remembering that each one is unique, and there's not a set timeline or a set path as to how we should be coping.
Right. Yeah, Jerry, that's well said. And go and continue to go back into the pieces of a disaster kind of process in regrieving. Oh, we're going to go to school. We're not going to go to school. We're going to go to school. We're not going to. I mean, that's really stressful and brings, oh, I thought I've accepted we're not going to go back to school, but now we are. Now we're not. So that grief work is just a continual right now. We don't know what the end looks like. I think that's part of the challenge that both Ingrid and Joey were talking about. It was what I was hearing. So, yeah, that challenge to even know when can we get to acceptance is we don't know that yet. We know what you said today, Chris, earlier, is what you repeated earlier, is that our mask mandates are now lessened if you've been vaccinated. But are people going to believe that? Are people even going to be willing to take off a mask? Some people will celebrate that. They never wore a mask. Okay, great. But the folks who have, that they're going to move in their own direction. And we have to be prepared for those type of stress reactions.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you all for those brilliant answers. I think the thing that one of the things that stuck out for me from that, as it relates to the question that we got in the chat box about how do we care for ourselves and grieve in a way that's going to allow us to enter into this new phase of our lives, is that's like, you know, the big life, all of us together. And I think it's really powerful. Just remember to be kind to yourself, be kind to others around you, and recognize that, you know, we're in uncharted territory in so many ways, and we each only know our own experience, and that is true and valid and okay. And so I think that's really powerful. I was as a public health person, I have to just say that I think one way that we can continue to move through this way together is if everybody gets both of their COVID shots, or one if they're getting the one shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But I think if we can continue to really message that, and, you know, remind our friends and families that, hey, if we are protecting ourselves, we can get back to maybe a type of community that we really love and we really miss in a quick fashion, compared to other pandemics, that will be really powerful. So that's my only soapbox for tonight, is get vaccinated. And I'm okay with it. So we're going to run out of our time. So I just have one last question that I would like each of you to speak to, and you've all spoken to it a little bit. And, you know, I want to say that I'm not really one that always has to end a conversation on a positive note. I think that sometimes that's not needed, but tonight it feels particularly important. So I'm wondering if each of you can just reflect on something or some things that as a result of this pandemic and its experience, we learned, or that we understand more holy now, or more that we understand better, that's going to be a positive thing for us moving forward. So one thing or a few things that we've learned or that we've understood more that's going to be helpful as we move forward. And I think this question ties into the last question we have from the chat box, which is really thinking about the pandemic of 1918, and thinking about if you want to tell us, and you can, but things that maybe we learned from that pandemic that we use today that have been helpful for us as well. So it's a big question, lots of agency to answer however you want to, but this is like the closing question for us to just kind of reflect on things we've learned and how that might help us moving forward. And anybody can start.
I don't want to play chicken, so I can go first. I think this has been a really meaningful conversation, and I think we've talked about across all ages. So we've talked a lot about kids, the stress of COVID on kids, and the mental health impact also on parents. And then I've tried to bring to the table also focus on our elders. And one sort of unexpected finding out of the pandemic that gives me a lot of hope and inspiration is there's been a couple surveys that have come out that say, even though it's the older adults who, you know, far and away have been most impacted physically in terms of getting sick and dying, surveys are showing that the ability to cope during COVID actually improves with age. And it's based on this theory of emotional development that when we're younger, say in our 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, we're thinking about stressing about things like, oh my God, what is my career going to be? Or will I get married? Do I want to have kids? Can I pay the mortgage? And then at a certain age, as people get older and they notice the narrowing horizon in front of them of their lifespan, consciously or not, they tend to get better at living in the moment. So this is a body of research that's come out primarily at the Center for Longevity at Stanford University. They've done a lot of studies around this phenomenon, this sort of unexpected phenomenon of ability to live in the moment and the happiness factor with older adults. And then true enough, there's been a survey by that entity as well as a few others that have affirmed it, that during COVID, if you compare indicators of happiness and a series of questions and surveys that have been asked of people of different ages, far and away the older adults come out as being more positive and being better able to emotionally provide to achieve well-being even in the face of this really prolonged stress of COVID. So that gives hope to all of us, because we know life is hard. It's hard when you're a kid. Parenting is stressful. Middle age is stressful. But as humans, we evolve and we get better at living in the moment, and get our resilience grows with age. So to me, that's hopeful right there.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I think that's a really powerful thing to remind ourselves of. And also as we're like continuing to have these conversations and thinking about, you know, how we are interacting with our different people in our communities and their responses to things, it's helpful to know too, to be thinking about, okay, if I'm working with, let's say an older adult, and you know, I might have a lot to learn from their experiences, being able to like move through this pandemic and like see the light at the end of the tunnel, or just be really focused on being present in the moment. So that's like, I think that for me really resonates on like, there's this need for us to, as we move through this next phase, to remember that we have so much to learn from each other, particularly, you know, and it's in this case, in your example, potentially older adults who have a lot to say about, you know, how to live in the moment a little bit better. So that's great. Thank you, Ingrid.
Take a shot at this. I like this line of question. It's good. I think about polio as much as I do the flu of 1918, right? I think polio was a piece where people had they developed a vaccine. I wouldn't say rapidly, but they got to a vaccine and people just kind of lined up and they put it on a sugar cube and they said, take it. And people took it. So I think we have more public debate now. And I know in a lot of ways that's stressful on the country, but we need to have public debate because this isn't going to be the last time we're stressed. And we need to work through this public debate about how we're going to care for each other and think about what's in best interest for not only ourselves, but others. And we've been confronted with the opportunity of growth, and hopefully we'll continue this conversation and we'll continue to develop an understanding of when we're more in the reconstruction phase, you know, because, you know, this can make a lot of people angry and frustrated. So we stay in an angry, frustrated stage for quite some time. So, and maybe there's a depression that'll come as well. And I think we've seen that in a lot of people, but we don't know if we're at the bottom of it or not. But it will give us a chance when we get to acceptance and reconstruction to really discuss what is it we're trying to achieve here. So I think that on the big scale, big picture for me is we can sit down and debate publicly and maybe come to a resolution about what it is we want to achieve. And on the back end, my hope is that we'll have a better understanding of how we're interacting with the world in a behavioral healthcare construct. And then we can get to a place where we can provide equitable response to that is what I believe we can do with this information, because that's what it is. It's information and feedback about how we were behaving and acting and living prior to.
Yeah. You know, as I think about this, when you were speaking, Chris, I was really thinking about some of the passion that has developed in some of the kids that I'm working with. It's astounding, you know, especially these adolescents, the amount of passion that they have and that really has surfaced during the pandemic is incredible. Like I turn my computer off or, you know, walk out of my office and I'm just like, this individual is going to change the world. I mean, they're strong, they're powerful. They, you know, I'm just seeing this beautiful evolution in some of these individuals. Like they're ready to get out there and conquer the world. You know, they feel like they've been stifled and they're ready to move. And so that has been really powerful thing that I have seen. And also, you know, I had a family yesterday and parents tell me this last year has been the best year that they have had with their children. They know their children on a different level than they did before COVID, right? It's allowed them to really have the time and give the attention to their kids that they weren't giving before, you know? And so I am seeing some of those pieces come out and some of these families feeling more connected and, you know, gaining a better understanding of one another.
That's great. Thank you, Jody. I think what I heard from that and from all the things you said, each of you around this topic is that one of the main things maybe that we learned from this that we can take away is just a reminder of the importance of being connected to the people around you and near you and having those conversations. And I think that could potentially represent a culture shift, at least in the United States anyways, around, you know, this sort of maybe re-intentional focus on being connected to things, spaces, people around you. I think for me, one thing that I was thinking about too, as you were all sharing, is just, and that we talked about already today, is that, you know, these advancements in how we view being able to care for people in their homes via telemedicine or telepsychiatry or telehealth in some ways, and that being something that, you know, 5 years ago, and the state of that we had was definitely not something we've been talking about being able to fund or to get, you know, reimbursed. And now that's a very different story, right? So there's those advancements in our understanding that I think are really powerful as well. I think earlier we talked a lot about, you know, having sort of a wake-up call for many of us about the crises that are already existing within our cultures around equity, whether that be income equity or racial equity, gender equity, all these things that if we don't meaningfully address, they're going to continue to get worse. So now we're, you know, I think culturally more aware, and there's a lot of energy to work to correct those so that we're, you know, for a whole bunch of reasons, but so that we're better prepared to be more resilient during the next crisis, because we won't have to be dealing with these underlying crises that we've been neglecting in many ways for generations. So that's a piece that I'm really excited about too in my work, just being able to have, I think, more frequent, more deep conversations around some of those issues that we've been talking about for a very long time. Those are all the questions that we have. Thank you to the panelists for spending this time with us. I learned a lot from you. I had a really, what I feel is a very meaningful conversation. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. I want to say thank you to Bozeman Public Library for creating the space, and the Bozeman Public Library Foundation for also creating this space.